Marxian historians insist that the affairs of the world can be understood by objective criteria. That if one could measure the means of production and distribution, the distribution of wealth between the classes of a society and between country and country, one could, in fact, predict, lay out the course of history, which follows very predictable lines, as those who lack seek to have, and those who have seek to protect. And at about the time that Marx was working through his so-called iron laws of history, a group of middle European political analysts, largely German, began to talk of what they called realpolitik. By realpolitik, they meant that the foreign ministries, the state departments, the powers of an individual country acted according to what was they called their national interest. And by their national interest, they defined as that which increased the wealth of the nation and prevented its diminution. And they spoke of almost like Marx did, of certain economic and political and production and military realities as being determinative. In the effect, nothing that individuals do care about really affect the course of history. Now, I would be the last to deny the critical importance of the so-called objective criteria in world affairs. Like individuals, nations are greedy. And like individuals, nations are ambitious. And like individuals, they will try to extend their wealth, their power as far as they can until they meet opposition, which they cannot overcome. And like individuals, the eye is never satisfied with seeing, and there's never enough. And so the reality of having and of wanting what someone else has does operate in a major way to determine the relationships between nations. But it's not the only determinative factor. If one were, for instance, to analyze the causes of the First World War, one would look at the societies of France and of Germany and of England, one would be hard-pressed to understand what it was and why it was that these three countries plunged themselves into a truly disastrous bloodbath. The distribution of wealth between the classes was about the same in these three European countries. Each was supported by a vast colonial empire which fed to its manufacturers raw materials fairly cheaply, which was then processed and returned to the world for great profit. There was enough. These were wealthy countries. They were governed by an elite which had intermarried, which largely shared Western European culture, Christianity, a whole variety of traditions. And yet they plunged themselves into 5 years of bloody combat. Over what? Personal honor? Some traditional cultural divisions? Language difficulties? Not the kind of objective criteria that the Marxist historian or the defender of realpolitik would argue should lead these countries into war. What I'm saying is that if you want to understand where a country is going, how it defines its national interest, you cannot leave out of consideration the nation's soul, what the people are feeling. And this is particularly true in free societies. Ultimately, the hopes, the visions, the fears, the anxieties, the prejudices, the hates of a community determine the limit within which its foreign ministry, its governing group can exert authority and make decisions. We can see that from our own country. After the bloody events of Vietnam, a mood of isolation, of retreat from the use of power, of suspicion of the institutions of power, swept over the land. And whether or not the government wanted to use the Marines, some instrument of our power, to free the hostages in Vietnam or for some other purpose, it was in effect shackled from doing so, because the country, the people, the soul of the nation was not prepared to exert power in that way at this point in time. And so what I'm suggesting is that if we want to know where Israel is headed, we have to know something about the soul of Israel. And to do so, we have to disembarrass ourselves of one conventional assumption, and that is that as fellow Jews, we respond instinctively to the political situations which confront Israel, which confront the world, the same way the Israeli do. And that is simply not the case. Of course, we share similar historical memories. Kishinev and the pogroms in Russia, Kristallnacht and Hitler and Auschwitz, Stalin and the purges and the fate of the Russian Jews have seared our souls as they have seared those of the Israelis. We share a religious calendar. We share Abraham and Moses and Hillel and Maimonides. But we do so from different perspectives, out of a different experience. A friend of mine, a retired rabbi, is in Jerusalem, and he's spending his retirement teaching English in an Israeli high school. And because he is a rabbi, he also once a week teaches a class in Bible. And he described to me a session with these Israeli high school students in which he was discussing the Akedah. You know the famous story we read every Rosh Hashanah, when God tells Abraham that as a test he is to take his son, his only son Isaac, and offer him up as a sacrifice to God in Mount Moriah. And my friend was making the well-accepted point that this story is not put into, was not put in the Bible to be a model for personal behavior. One of the early existentialist philosophers of Christianity, Soren Kierkegaard, analyzing the story of the Akedah, insisted that this taught that the religious man must be willing to suspend the ethical when the commands of God require this of him, that we must follow God, whatever be the conventional moral assumptions of the world of which we're a part. And he was making the point, because this is a dangerous idea, that when the voice speaks, one must do whatever the voice tells us to do. He was speaking of how the Bible expresses itself on many different levels. And in point of fact, the Akedah was understood by the Jewish tradition almost from the beginning the same way Christianity has understood the crucifixion story. That is, that it is described in the Bible as a test. It is an explanation offered by the Bible of why it is that God chose this particular man, Abraham, and his descendants, what it was that he had done which was so exceptional, what sacrifice had been prepared to make. Not in one case, not his own life, but the life of his son, in order to prove his loyalty to God. And it was not a pattern of behavior that ought to be replicated, repeated by anyone. And after all, he said, no father would willingly sacrifice his son on the altar of his hopes. And there was a stirring in the class. And he looked around, he didn't quite understand it, and finally one of the youngsters said to him, but every one of our fathers has done the same thing, simply by coming to Israel. Every one of us has been, in a sense, exposed on the altar. Death is very near to us. Now, our children vibrate to hell no, we won't go, which is their way of saying that as long as they've been alive, whatever foreign adventures, whatever uses of power the American government has been involved in, have been in faraway places, in Korea or Vietnam. They've been quasi-colonial wars for unclear purposes. They've certainly not been wars where one was defending one's home, one's family, one's very life. The Israeli youth, on the other hand, have no history of draft resistance. They go again and again and again, and they're mobilized again and again and again. And there is no history of draft resistance because they know that the wars that they are involved in are wars of survival. That if they lose, they, their families, their communities disappear off the face of the earth. And so there is deep within the soul of our youngsters, the soul of their young people, some basic differences. There are differences between the adults in that society and us. We have been gentled and tempered by prosperity and by power. And we've lived under in a country where we have been protected from foreign invasion, where until quite recently there was always more and more, it seemed, at the end of every year. We've come to believe that there should be reasonable solutions to all the complex problems of the world. The Israeli of our age, experience, has been toughened and gnarled, if you will, by austerity. He's never known prosperity. He's never been able really to expect to live more comfortably at the end of a year than he lived at the beginning of that year. He's had to put his life on the line again and again in five wars. Many who come back from Israel comment on the difficulty of having what we call a reasonable conversation with family and with friends. They seem to know it all. They insist there's only one way of looking at things. They're obstinate. Those are some of the kinder phrases I've heard. And they are. Because if they're wrong, their lives may be lost. We can afford to be detached, philosophic, about the fate of some other place in the world. We love to have long, philosophic, political discussions about what our policies ought to be in the Far East, in Southeast Asia, wherever it may be, Latin America. The Israelis are preoccupied with one area, and they know that politics is not a philosophic undertaking. But ultimately, it's a matter of holding on to what you have and preventing someone else from taking what is yours. And that those who argue reasonably are often innocents abroad, whose very innocence would lead to their destruction. Some 6 months ago, in March of this year, the Open Forum Journal of our State Department published a very interesting analysis of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and a series of proposals. The Open Forum Journal is a non-official publication of people unsponsored by the State Department for the use of the State Department, in which various groups who have interest in one part of the world or another suggest in print what they would like their seniors and the ultimate policymakers to be thinking about. In this case, a small group of younger State Department people suggested to their seniors through this article what they thought would be a reasonable solution, adjustment of the Palestinian-Israeli problem. And the article is, in fact, reasonable. They argue that there ought to be a Palestinian state, but that there must be security provisions made for Israel. Israel should be allowed to maintain forward positions, early warning, radar posts and the like along the Jordan River and elsewhere. They argue that Jerusalem must remain undivided, that it ought to be the capital of both this Palestinian state and Israel. And because no one will ever agree as to which of the groups should govern this undivided city, it ought to be run by a city manager, and they even suggest that this city manager be appointed by the International Committee of City Managers for someone who is neither Jewish nor Muslim nor Arab Christian. They speak of the Israeli settlements, and they say that these settlements ought not to be increased and new settlements ought not to be placed. But they say that to encourage Israel to enter into these negotiations and to accept these positions, those Israeli settlements which are in place ought to be allowed to remain as part of the of a Palestinian Arab state, the same way Arabs communities remain in Israel, and they ought to be protected by some kind of international guarantee. Now, what could be more reasonable? What could be more even-handed? It's this kind of thinking which underlies President Reagan's proposals of the 1st of September. It's this kind of thinking which appeals to many in the larger community and to many within our own community who keep looking over their shoulders to make sure that their positions are in agreement with my Yomru Hagoyim, what others are saying. I described this article, in this late spring to an Israeli friend, and he smiled, and he said, when the Messiah comes. And what he was saying was simply this. What Palestinian government would be satisfied with a sovereignty which allowed the Israeli army to maintain forward military positions within its own national boundaries? And how long would it be before Israel felt it necessary to protect the rights of its settlers in this Palestinian state, who were increasingly being treated as second-class citizens? And how long would it be before the mobs were in the street in some marketplace in Jerusalem complaining bitterly that this policeman or that guard had mistreated one side or the other? And how would these issues ultimately be adjudicated? Politics, international affairs, is not simply a matter of reason. In fact, reason plays the least of roles, usually, in the affairs of men. Passion, ambition, historical memory, greed, all of these play more important roles. One of the problems with the so-called reasonable solutions which are being advanced by the West European governments and now by the United States and by many groups within the United States is that they rest on an assumption. And the assumption is that once the Palestinians have been granted sovereignty, however limited that sovereignty will in fact be, their needs will have been met and they will quiet down. And that is arrant nonsense. The eye is never satisfied with seeing. Politicians want always more effective power. The Israelis have good reason to know that Palestinian ambition will not be satisfied with some minor rights to run up a flag in Nablus or Shechem, to have a national council for over the domestic issues of their country. That's not the way people operate. We want more, always. And one could justify in terms of absolute rights, their right to absolute sovereignty. And beyond that, the Israeli know that even if these Palestinians are granted sovereignty in the West Bank and Gaza, there will be millions, several millions Palestinians who will be remain outside of this area. They cannot be assimilated into it. And they will continue to be restless and to demand and to insist on rights which they consider their own. They will consider demand that old orchard which my great-grandfather had in what is now Tel Aviv. And that orchard, whatever it was, before 1948 has grown 10 times in size, as the story has been repeated in the decades since 1948. One of the problems which we all have in understanding Israel and understanding our own attitudes towards Israel is that we are operating from the comfort and the security and from within the from under the umbrella of power, which is the United States. When we look philosophically at the world, what do we see? Well, for historians, we look back and we see that the 18th and 19th century have been the era of the rise of nationalism. We see the formation of the national states of Europe. We've seen country after country demand independence from colonial rule. Around the world, we've learned that there are liberation groups of one kind or another demanding their rights. And it seemed to us only inevitable, natural right that all peoples have their independence. It doesn't threaten us very much. Unless we remember how we felt 15 years ago when some militant blacks were demanding a black state carved out of the South. Or as we remember what we're really saying when we smile tolerantly when we hear that some Indian tribes are demanding half of Maine or a good part of the western states. In point of fact, national rights are not ultimate, inevitable, or necessarily achievable. If you live in the Middle East, you know that the Turkish government 60 years ago and a few more years, destroyed almost forever the national rights of the Armenians. They did so very simply, by genocide. And if we remember our recent history, although the papers tend not to cover that this part of the Middle East, in the last 20 years or so, Iraq and Iran, though they fight with each other, have effectively conspired to destroy the national rights of the Kurdish people. A mountain people of several million who live in that mountainous region between Iran and Iraq and who had, up till 30 years ago or so, semi-independent authority over the countryside. And if we're familiar with the history of nation states in Africa, we recognize that in almost every situation, some tribe has seized the powers of government and the national rights of the other tribes have been ruthlessly and routinely denied. So in point of fact, simply because one claims national rights, one not necessarily achieve those rights. And that though there are conflicts, obviously, though there is right on the side of the Palestinians in demanding what they need, those rights conflict with the ability of the Israeli people to survive. And when rights conflict, there's going to be conflict. And when rights conflict and there is conflicts, reasonable solutions are rarely achievable solutions. Usually the only achievable solution is a military one, either a balance of power which achieves a temporary truce or something of that, or some third power imposing its authority on smaller groups. When the Israelis look at the so-called reasonable solutions proffered in Washington and elsewhere, they know that because now more than half of the Israelis have been nurtured within a Muslim and Arab environment and not within a European environment, they know that the Arabs are a deeply, passionately religious people, and that one of the basic assumptions of Islam is that there's something called Dar al-Islam, lands which have become Muslim, and that it is a matter of dogma, that once a land has become Muslim, it may not revert to what they call Dar al-Khab, a land which is non-Muslim, which is belongs to some pagan group, some alien group, and that the ultimate proof text of this, which every Arab child knows, is the history of the Crusades, where the West came east and established in Jerusalem and Antioch and Acre for almost a century a beachhead, but was ultimately driven out, because Dar al-Khab may not impose itself upon Dar al-Islam. And they know that Arab school children are taught this basic equation in the cradle, and that it is a basic assumption of Arab thinking and of Arab policy. Now, if we accept the world from within which the Israeli lives and thinks and makes his political judgments, we must remember one other thing, that unlike our world, it's a world utterly without dependable allies. The United States has done a great deal for Israel over the last 30 plus years, financially, economically. We're the one power in the world which has been willing to sell to Israel advanced, sophisticated weapons. Now, the Israelis usually have to improve these a bit before they become effective. And Israel has many reasons to be grateful to the United States. But the Israelis also remember those terrible 3 days in October of 1973 when the Syrians attacked with the Egyptians, but the Syrians, remember, overran the Golan Heights. And during those three first days of the war, Mr. Kissinger choked back any and all supply of arms to Israel. They were ultimately alone. They had no guarantee that on the fourth day supplies would be forthcoming. Their backs were to the wall. And the Israelis have never forgotten that. So ultimately, if you are an Israeli, you must begin to make your judgments not from some abstract set of moral principles which operate in a denatured way up there in the air, but recognizing that every action that you take may be an ultimately fatal one, that there's almost no margin for error, that you cannot eschew the use of power because you've been placed under a state of permanent siege, really, for the last 35 years. Now, there are in the West those who believe that any use of power corrupts and must be avoided. But if you're an Israeli, you can't have that luxury. There are in the West those who argue that reasonable solutions ought to be easily adopted. But if you're an Israeli, you remember that if you give back the West Bank and Gaza, you'll never be able to reclaim it, and that the guns which will be brought into the West Bank will easily control Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, the whole coastal highway, almost the entire state. Israel went into Lebanon, you'll recall, to create a 40-mile buffer zone to create the Galil. There's no area in Israel, except deep in the Negev, where there's almost no building, which is more than 40 kilometers away from some Arab border, if the West Bank and Gaza are given back. Israel will not be reasonable in the years that lie ahead. Israel, because it will not be reasonable, will increasingly be at odds with those who want to impose reason upon it, the governments of Western Europe and our own government. It didn't take but a day after the election, after the Jewish vote had been cast one way or the other, before this administration was again loudly complaining about Mr. Begin's policy of settlement on the West Bank. Poll after poll in Israel have revealed an interesting phenomenon, and that is that despite everything that we think has happened in the Lebanon and has been involved in Lebanese activity, Mr. Begin is more popular today than he was before the Lebanese invasion. And that just as before the Lebanese invasion, the Likud, his party, has very little great popular support. Most people don't understand or approve of its platform among those who vote for it. They're voting for Mr. Begin. They're voting for a feisty, doughty, difficult, old man who has forgotten nothing about all the suffering and all the indignities that the Jews have suffered from Kishinev till today. An old man who is unreasonable. And they're voting for him, a majority of the Israelis, precisely because he is unreasonable. Now, I'm not going to stand here and say to you that I agree with or would justify all or the major part of his policies. Many, I think, have been strategically mistaken. On the other hand, I think it's important for all of us to recognize that if we want to know where Israel is going, it's going in the direction that Mr. Begin has pointed. Washington has made a great thing about trying to unseat Mr. Begin to get a more amenable or agreeable group of people, the Labor Party, into power. But when one analyzes the platforms of the Labour Party and of Mr. Begin, there's really very little difference. The difference is almost more in semantics than it is in substance. The Labour Party never talks about Judea and Samaria, never brings up those images of the unreasonable past, of the unreasonable biblical claims, unreasonable in quotation marks, which Mr. Begin constantly advances. But no one in the Labour Party has agreed to a totally independent Palestinian state on the West Bank. Nobody in the Labour Party has ever imagined that Jerusalem would be the capital of a Palestinian state. No one in the Labour Party has agreed to any policy which would demand the exclusion of Jews from settlement on the West Bank, that of all places in the world, the only place where Jews may not settle, the only place which must be Judenrein, is the West Bank and Gaza. There's a difference in semantics, a difference in approach. But in substance, the Labour Party is as unreasonable as is Mr. Begin. It's simply that Mr. Begin finds rather difficult phrases, phrases which cast the gauntlet down to other powers when he uses that power. It's only that there's something about his personality which many in the West find difficult to accept. And I try to analyze that in my own mind. And I think it comes to this very question of reasonableness. In the West, we like to think of people who represent governments as ultimately reasonable people who will operate reasonably. We don't like to think of people who are moved by religious or mystical or nationalist ambitions whose vision does not somehow transcend the rights of survival, the needs of their country. Mr. Begin represents a country which we thought operated from the same perspective as we do. And we're discovering, and we don't know quite how to adjust to it, that Mr. Begin operates from a country which is, in fact, in an old-fashioned way, a Jewish national home, and a country which is not willing to be agreeable, amenable, to compromise, to be reasonable. You know, one of the facts of modern life, which not only in the case of Israel, but in the case of most of the world, America tends constantly to underestimate, is the charm of unreason to people. When you look about the world, most of the great political movements, most of the wars, most of the pressures for change are unreasonable. They're ideological, they're religious. But we like to continue to think that realpolitik, some objective criteria of national interest, determines what countries do. No national interest determined that the Phat Phol in Cambodia would destroy nearly one-third of its own population. No narrow concept of national interest will explain what's happening in Afghanistan or the constant conflict between Pakistan and India. Nothing that is reasonable will explain what's been happening in Iran the last 5 years or so. Nor is it reasonable to explain what's happening in Latin America purely in terms of the rise of oppressed peoples. Much more is at stake. Religious issues, mystical issues, national issues, chauvinistic issues, cultural issues, ethnic issues, all these are part and parcel of the stormy, convulsive political world which is out there. And what we don't like really about Mr. Begin is that he articulates some of the Jewish storm, the Jewish anger, the Jewish memory. And you know, it's the dislike of Mr. Begin is irrational. He's painted as a belligerent, bellicose man who will not give an inch. But in point of fact, he gave back the entirety of the Sinai. He's described as a difficult, almost medieval man who has forgotten nothing about the Holocaust, who's forgotten that this is a brand new age, and has always forgotten that it was he who, in April of this year, sent his own troops against his own citizens, against those citizens who were part of the B'nai Akiva and the Gush Emunim, those ultra-rightist groups, who were squatting in Yamit, squatting in the few remaining settlements in the Sinai, insisting that this land not be given back. And Mr. Begin sent his own troops against his own people in order to live up to his pledge of return. He is not, if a Martian were to come down to the earth and to judge the activities of the Israeli government, he would not see it as that kind of intransigent, belligerent, bellicose government which the mass media and some Jews, too, have increasingly agreed that it must be. Because there's no basis for the judgment, except perhaps the choice of language, which Mr. Begin makes from time to time. Mr. Begin does something we don't like to think about. And yet we must think about it because it's reality. He uses power. Now, there may be times when he ought not to use power. But by the use of power, he's saying simply, there's a real world out there. There are people who hate us. There are people who would slit our throats. There are people from whom we must protect ourselves. There are certain things that we must do. We cannot allow a nuclear reactor to be built in Iraq, because if it's built, the first bomb will be thrown against Tel Aviv. I have more trouble, really, understanding the use of power, let's say, on the West Bank than I do in the Lebanon. On the West Bank, in the last 6 or 8 months or so, Israeli troops have removed a number of Arab mayors from office. They have moved against the normal political life in the communities, particularly in the universities. A number of the newspapers, which were most PLO belligerent, were temporarily or permanently shut down. There have been stone-throwing incidents. The homes of certain people who would actively committed sabotage have been blown up. It's not a pretty picture. And yet, if one looks at it from the point of view of Jerusalem and not the point of view of Washington or Cleveland, one recognizes that what Mr. Begin is trying to do is simply to counter power with power. Since 1967, whenever a group in the West Bank has said, yes, we'd like to begin to work out arrangements with Israel, economics, political, social, autonomy talks on a level that Israel might accept, the PLO has assassinated, and it has used its brutal powers quite freely and quite easily. The mayors who have been removed from office were all part of a National Council of Palestinians, which was dominated by and run by PLO interests. The PLO has been an effective shadow government on the West Bank. And what the Israelis have tried to do in the last year and a half is to counter power with power by finding in the so-called village councils, people who would agree to meet with them and to begin to build certain kinds of ties, and then to empower them against those who have used power to suppress dissent from the PLO position. What they've tried to do is to separate out the Palestinian interests from PLO interests, and they're not identical. It's been an ugly scene. There's been bloodshed. There's been the naked use of force. But can we arbitrarily and totally fault Mr. Begin and his government for having done what they have done? Yes, power corrupts. Yes, power can be abused. Yes, the Israelis have abused their power. But what country hasn't? What government doesn't? And how does one survive without the use of power? It's a hard question. Each issue then must be judged on its own merit. But what I've been trying to say to you this morning is that the kind of standard which many in Washington and increasingly in our own Jewish community would like to impose upon Israel, at least find the Israeli government abiding, is a romantic, innocent, suicidal posture. Israel is not one of the 32 self-governing units within Cuyahoga County. It's not a little government. It has nothing to fear except the fact that it may not get as much of state or federal monies as it, this year as it got last year. It's a country out there in the jungle called the Middle East. It's out there among nations, many of whom would like to slit its throats, none of whom, with the exception of Egypt, have yet admitted its existence. It's out there in an Arab world which is surgent, militaristic, sensing its power, not about to compromise with its vision of Dar al-Islam. Yes, the Israelis could find a way to explain in a more effective manner their use of power. Yes, Mr. Begin might be another kind of person whose choice of words would not be so much those of a pugnacious little lawyer who has to make his case over and over and over again until everyone is tired of it. But whoever was in power in Israel would have to use power. And because of that, when we ask, where is Israel going? The answer, I think, is simply this. Israel is going in a direction which American interests will not readily agree with. Israel is going in a direction which American Jewry is going to be unhappy with, because it's going to force us to defend an increasingly unpopular position. The settlements will continue. Changes are taking place on the ground. It's precisely what the Israelis are trying to do. The Israelis will from time to time misuse their army and their power. They will continue to be a strong military power. Their lives, their survival depend upon it. They will, if they are wise, continue to look for ways to adjudicate, to meet with, and to negotiate. But what the world is asking of them, they cannot give. And that's the sum and substance of it. And so, we're headed for a period which will be a period of tension, anxiety, difficulty. And I guess what concerns me most in this period is not the Israeli will, or even the wisdom of Israeli leaders. They're as fallible and prone to mistakes as God knows our leaders are. But it's the spirit and the understanding of the diaspora, of you and of me, to recognize that before we make judgments, we ought to remember the old rabbinic principle. Al tadin et chavercha ad shetagia limkomo. Don't judge another person until, through the power of your imagination, you can place yourself in his own, her own position. Don't judge Israel or any country in this world until you can imagine what life is like, what the needs of that country are, what survival requires of them. Don't impose the standards of comfortable, secure America on the austerity, the discomfort, the insecurity, the mortal danger in which Israel lives. Amen.